I'm Bill Lako with Ted Parrish, Dr. Gene Hensler, and Marlon Cook, Regional Manager for the Division of Insurance and Research from the FDIC. Marlon, thanks again for being here. Can you just take just a brief second and explain how the FDIC insurance works?
Well, FDIC insurance is available at $250,000. That's the cap. So if you have an account at a bank, checking, savings, what have you, we cover your insurance, your accounts, up to $250,000 per individual. And you can aggregate that for husband and wife, family members, if it's your child, and you can get more coverage. But at the individual level, it's $250,000 per account.
So a husband and wife, theoretically, he could have an account with $250,000. She could have an account with $250,000. Can they have a joint account with $250,000?
And they can have a joint account with
$250,000. Okay. Now, the banks actually pay for that, don't they, in the savings and loans, because they pay a fee, don't they?
That's correct. We charge what we call assessments, and it's our deposit insurance fund. That's the backstop that provides the guarantee, the $250,000 guarantee. So when we do have to pay out, we take the money from our deposit insurance fund, and we do assess the banks a fee for the coverage.
And that fee's gone up over the past couple of years, right?
The fee has gone up in so much as we have had failures recently, and we obviously have to keep money in the fund. So part of that is assessing
fees.
There
was concern that there wasn't going to be enough money in there. Now, that doesn't mean the insurance won't be good. I'm not trying to imply that. But that's changed, hasn't it? Because there have been much fewer bank failures, and the money's still flowing in from the banks now.
Right. I think there's a confusion when you say there's a concern that there wouldn't be money in there. We have a backstop with the U.S. Treasury, so we do have borrowing authority. So there should
I wasn't implying that you couldn't pay because it was borrowing capacity, but prior to this financial problems, there's always been a real strong positive cash flow flowing into that fund.
Right. The fund has had a positive balance, but when you get hit with a rash of failures in a short period of time, that balance dissipates over time, and the assessments are not enough to bring that balance back to a positive at any point in time really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the reserves that we carry and the borrowing authority will come in. So nobody should ever be under the impression that the insurance
is
not available to cover the
How long deposits. Is it going to stay at two? Is it, has that been made permanent to the 250?
Yes, the 250 through the Dodd-Frank is now permanent.
Permanent. Okay. I know that they were going to do it for a year, then they extended it, and then the Dodd-Frank made it permanent.
That's correct.
That's good, especially, I just want to make a statement, especially in a market when they're talking about Greece and the problem over there is probably going to put more pressure on the money market funds. It's good to have that backstop and that they made it permanently. How is the banking environment right now in terms of earnings in Georgia?
In Georgia, the environment is still challenged, I would say that. It's better than it was a year ago. The percent of institutions headquartered in Georgia that lost money in the first quarter was about 38%. It was 44% in the year ago quarter. So while we still have a significant number of institutions losing money, that percentage has dropped over time as we have come through the recession and now in recovery. So things are getting better in Georgia. But it's still challenging when you look at the rest of the nation where the percent of institutions losing money is a lot lower than 38%.
What about the capital base? That's improved, hasn't it, also for the banks?
Surprisingly, despite what you might think, capital levels for Georgia banks have stayed pretty healthy through the course of this crisis. It's still just slightly under 9% in the aggregate for the industry, which is down from almost 10%. But that's very much above the minimum requirements.
Yeah, I know a lot of banks that we're familiar with have been raising capital, making a point of that.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. And they've been successful in doing that, especially the larger banks.
Okay, so you mentioned that FDIC limits were raised permanently because of the Dodd-Frank bill. How has the Dodd-Frank bill changed the role of the FDIC?
Well, the role is really the same as it was back in 1933 when we were created, which is to promote financial stability and public confidence in banking through our supervision and deposit insurance and orderly resolving of failed financial institutions. Under Dodd-Frank, we did get authority to update our deposit insurance assessment rules. There's a provision in there to end too big to fail, where we would gain resolution authority over systemically important financial institutions and establish a floor for risk-based capital requirements, which is really an increase in the capital requirements.
Right. Yeah, I want to talk to you about that.
So those are three of the real positives in terms of additional authority that we received under the Dodd-Frank Act.
There's talk of capital requirements going as high as, what, 14% or something like that?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. The capital requirements for the general industry is a tier one risk base of 4% and total risk base of 8%. Then you have your large internationally active institutions. And heretofore, they were allowed to operate under sort of a advanced approach, meaning they could utilize the internal risk-based system, meaning they set their own capital,
so to speak. We know how that worked.
Based on their rules, because you have international components, so you want the large U.S. American banks to compete with their international companies. So something called Basel III came out. Mm-hmm. And we've now said that whether you're using this so-called advanced approach where you can rely on your internal models, your capital has to be the higher of the two approaches, the general approach that I just told you mm-hmm. about, 4% and 8%, or the advanced approach. So even if your internal risk-based model says you should only have 3%, you have to keep the higher of the general approach or the advanced approach.
Where's this 14% coming from? Is this coming from Europe? Do they want to raise the banks in Europe to have a 14% capital?
Actually, the international banks are against it.
Oh. Hmm. So I thought they were the ones putting the pressure on.
No, they're not putting the pressure on. I think they're probably thinking, we like it the way it is. But again, in this country, at least our position is we think capital is really important. If nothing else, this crisis should confirm that to anybody who wants to look at the numbers. The banks that had capital at the beginning of the crisis, enough of it were able to make it through despite significant losses.
Well, the banks, I know, would be very unhappy if it went to 14%, since it would really cut their profitability. Return on equity is what it would mm-hmm. do.
That's true. But that's where you get into this internal ratings-based approach and how much capital you should have.
Yeah, but that's just for the big guys. I mean, the small town bank, they can't get away with that. They've got to live with the 4 and the 8.
Yes, and the small town bank doesn't have the same risk operations and risks that the large internationally active banks have. So they don't need to fool around with an internal model, because they're not into derivatives markets. They don't have overseas offices. They're not buying these CMOs and things of that nature. So they can operate under what we call the general approach, which is from the FDIC standpoint. That's that 4% and 8% total risk
base. I don't know if this is outside your area of expertise, so don't be afraid to say I don't know. Okay, and that is they're postponing segments of the Dodd-Frank bill. I just saw that they were going to postpone some implementations. Do you happen to know what those were?
Not specifically. I know the areas that I just touched on are at least the capital regime. That rule was passed or implemented by the federal regulators yesterday, but Dodd-Frank gave us instructions to implement that, so that has gone into effect. In too big to fail part, that's still being debated in Congress, so maybe that part of it is what you
I didn't get a chance to read before.
They're still waiting on that to announce or appoint a head of the new Consumer Protection Agency, right? And if they don't.
Well, there's some derivative rules that have not been created yet, and I know that's mm-hmm. pretty dicey little area that you got to be an expert mm-hmm. on.
So do you think, how has this new era of regulation affected us in the different regions? Is there any perspective you can give us on how the different regions may be affected?
Yeah, I think there's maybe a little confusion there, because you look at Dodd-Frank, you think of new regulations. And remember, Dodd-Frank is primarily to level the playing field from community banks and large banks. So your community banks, which are the majority in terms of number of banks in the country, they're not going to be really impacted as much by Dodd-Frank per se. So when you talk about new regulations, mm-hmm. whether you're talking about deposit insurance assessment, that's to level the playing field about who pays what vis-a-vis the risk they pose to the fund. So that's going to affect large banks. Mm-hmm. You talk about ending too big to fail, that's going to affect large banks. You talk about the new capital rules, that's going to affect large banks. So in terms of impacting community banks across the region, we just don't see a lot there for your community bank. So they have probably the same amount of regulation now that they had prior to Dodd-Frank.
Is it safe to say that there won't be any new banking charters in the near future.
I can't speak to that. You'd have to get the Georgia Bank Commission on here for that.
So, Marlon, at least here in Georgia, it seems like the news about the banks is getting better, at least what I hear on TV. Is that y'all's position?
Yes. I think you had 21 bank failures in Georgia in 2010. You had 12 year-to-date in 2011 through last weekend. You have better profitability, meaning a lower percentage of banks losing money than a year ago, even lower when you go back 2 years ago. But the Georgia banks were disproportionately affected by the recession. Right. So they're still earning less money on an average basis than similarly situated banks in the country. But the economy here was a lot worse than it was in other parts of the country.
How about Georgia versus Florida?
Georgia versus Florida. Florida would win that.
They're better shape.
No.
Is he talking about football?
They're in worse shape.
Worse shape. Oh, okay.
I was about to say, wow.
I thought he was talking about football there.
Okay. All right. Okay. And then if we go around the region, our neighbor's Tennessee.
Tennessee, we don't cover Tennessee.
Oh, I thought you did.
No, North Carolina.
Okay, North Carolina.
North Carolina. Well, let me put it this way. Among the seven states we cover, if you rank them in reverse order, meaning who's doing the poorest in terms of the average banking performance, Florida would be your leader. Then it would be Georgia. There'd probably be a tie between North Carolina, South Carolina, and Alabama, and West Virginia and Virginia doing the best.
Wow. Okay. Well, Virginia, of course, is on the border of Washington, D.C., which is the only area in which employment has increased over the period of time.
Yep.
So that probably makes the big difference, because that's where most of the population is, isn't it, outside of Washington?
That's correct. And the economics there in the suburban Washington, northern Virginia area were very much supportive during this crisis, at least if you're a bank, which you need good employment, people with jobs, spending money, putting deposits in your bank, coming to you for loans. So
property values have gone up in the area.
We were just talking about employment. Gene, just go out and hire some more people.
Well, one of the things you have to remember about the Atlanta market and the Georgia, too, is that we've got a whole bunch of people who come down from Michigan looking for work and move here. They'd rather be unemployed in Georgia than unemployed in Michigan. And believe me, being from Michigan, I see where they're coming from.
Well, from a banking perspective, the actual migration into Georgia slowed considerably, which is one of the reasons why the residential lot development business dried up. And when that happened, as you know, you don't buy a lot, put in streets and lights, and then 30 days later, a house pops up and you sell it. You have to plan for that.
Years
in advance. So the banking industry was funding that type of growth, but that had to be done well before the person comes here and actually puts a contract. So then when that went away, all of a sudden a lot of home builders, developers were stuck with these lots. Well, guess who financed those lots?
Right.
So we're still working our way through that.
But let me tell you, when the turnaround comes, I always see the light there. Okay. When the turnaround comes, it's going to be my mind, especially in real estate, because the guys who have got some deep pockets went out and bought these developments at a dime on a dollar.
Did you read the article I sent last night? I actually have to give Ted Parrish his props, because according to this guy, I don't have it in front of me, but according to the gentleman I sent the article from Fox News, this is now the worst real estate market.
He's about 3 or 4 months late. If you look on that board out there, I posted some up there. I was waiting for you guys to actually see it. I posted it up there like 3 or 4 months ago.
Yeah, but I actually respect this
guy. There was a big article.
Fox Barrett, Business News?
No, I didn't say Fox Business.
There was a big article.
Actually, it might have been New York Times.
There was a big article in the Wall Street Journal or Barron's about a month or two ago that talked about this.
But anyhow,
what I'm saying is that when this real estate market turns around, there's going to be a fortune made in real estate.
Lagging indicators.
Marlon, last question. If you can say what the FDIC's outlook is for the Southeast and Georgia for rest of the year, possibly next year, if you guys got a crystal ball. I do have an eight ball if you want to.
Well, we don't make forecasts for public consumption, but what we do.
We won't tell anybody.
We do.
Is this live? Is this on? Are we on? No, just kidding.
We listen to a lot of the professional forecasters and
laugh.
if you think about it intuitively, Georgia will be fine over the long term. You still have a couple of things working for you. You've got a strong coast, meaning the Savannah area, shipyards. Mm-hmm. All right, you have good weather compared to a lot of the rest of the country. The migration will return. job growth in several sectors in Georgia, manufacturing, professional business services, et cetera, has actually been doing much better in the first part of the year than other parts of the country. You have affordable housing, much more affordable than other parts of the country. So we just need the job engine to speed up. You already have low-cost housing. You've got a good climate. You've got a good coastline. So the same ingredients that made Georgia a star in the earlier in the decade are still here.
All right.
I agree.
Well, that's good news. All right, listen, we appreciate you coming in. We are. So you'll come back next quarter?
Sure.
And you'll show me the error of my ways again.
So. Well, you come back next quarter, maybe we can play golf afterwards.
Oh yeah, because he's working hard too, just like Gene.
Afterwards, so that's like 4:30, okay?
Yeah.
I come in at 5:30 a.m.
Oh, yeah. All right, well, it's been a slice of heaven. We'll see you next week. Marlon, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Take care.
All material presented is compiled from sources believed to be reliable and current, but accuracy cannot be guaranteed. The contents are intended for general information purposes only. Information provided should not be the sole basis in making any decisions and is not intended to replace the advice of a qualified professional, such as a tax consultant, insurance advisor, or attorney. Although this material is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information with respect to the subject matter, it may not apply in all situations. This is not to be construed as an offer to buy or sell any financial instruments. It is not our intention to state, indicate, or imply in any manner that current or past results are indicative of future profitability or expectations. Portfolio holdings discussed are subject to change. There is no guarantee that in the future these securities will be held in Hensler accounts. As with all investments, there are associated inherent risks. Please obtain and review all financial material carefully before investing. Hensler is not licensed to offer or sell insurance products. This overview is not to be construed as an offer to purchase any insurance products.